From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Go to the website, bbcnews.com. Not much doubt about what people are clicking onto. And Thursday, most popular story, North America's big freeze seen from space. Wednesday, North America temperature records tumble. Tuesday, North America deep freeze hits east. Monday, North America shivers. Sunday, polar vortex grips North
2 weeks ago, Winter Storm Hercules, and this week the polar vortex, gave the media a massive frisson.
Of course, we've been talking about the winter storm that they've named Hercules. This storm is expected to affect 100 million people across 22 states.
A major airline is going to shut down operations at some big U.S. airports to give its system and its employees a chance to keep up with the cold.
If you're under 30 years old, you've probably never felt cold like this in your life.
Yes. We're being hit by a polar vortex and thunder snow. And frankly, folks, I'm not sure if those are weather patterns or finishing moves from Mortal Kombat.
Pontificators and politicians filled the jet stream with unbounded extrapolation. From Republican James Inhofe.
There's been a concerted effort of people to believe that global warming is taking place, that we're all going to die and all of that. It's almost laughable.
And Charlie Rose.
Is it definitely connected to a global warming?
Potentially, it's connected to that.
Potentially. I
mean, these have been happening already.
Rush Limbaugh.
Right on schedule, the media have to come up with a way to make it sound like it's completely unprecedented. So no matter how they go at this, they're losing. They're in the middle of a hoax, and so they created a polar vortex.
Well, a lot of folks have been saying there's no such thing as a polar vortex, and that it's some left-wing media conspiracy.
And Al Roker. Oh, wait. He shouldn't be in this montage. He's a weatherman, so he probably actually knows what he's talking about.
This is from my textbook from college, the Glossary of Meteorology from the American Meteorological Society, copyright 1959, okay? Right here, okay? Polar vortex. There it is. So for all the doubters out there, stuff it!
This cold winter has also been, in terms of the media, a silly season, filled with hokum, twaddle, drivel, bunkum, specifically what philosopher Harry Frankfurt would call bull manure, so to speak. It's a byproduct of our culture of blather where, quote, people are frequently impelled, whether by their own propensities or by the demands of others, to speak extensively about matters of which they are to some degree ignorant. This, unplanned, turned out to be the theme of this week's show.
Some of the hooey we address this hour is inadvertent, a byproduct of the attempt by its propagators to amuse the audience. Some of it may be intentional, an effort to mislead. But in most cases, the audience participates in its own deception, especially perhaps when it comes to the weather. Andrew Revkin runs the Dot Earth blog at the New York Times.
That tendency in journalists and, of course, in audiences to gravitate toward the dramatic when it fits a worldview is hard to fight back against. I even created a little emblem, looks like a caution sign, a roadway sign that I put on tweets. It's called Single Study Syndrome, to sort of put a warning label when I'm writing about this pattern. And by the way, this extends to everything from PCBs and farmed salmon to the latest thinking on coffee and health to, of course, climate change.
If I, as a news consumer, read a story that says, this proves global warming, this proves you should drink more coffee, this proves that you should not drink coffee, what happens to me?
You end up with whiplash. A guaranteed, that form of journalism, just going from one news peg to the next without building in the context, especially with science, which is all about context, the journey, you end up disengaging the very people who you should be trying to engage.
Over the last week or so, has there been any single story that made your head spin around like the kid in The Exorcist?
Yeah, every time I heard Winter Storm Hercules, I would go, oh my God, there it is again. This is driving me crazy. Because it was a pretty unremarkable storm, and the idea that these are somehow as momentous as hurricanes, getting into the whole issue whether the Weather Channel, you know, has the right to name storms. There was a columnist, he said he just was getting over sinus infection Fred, because he was so sick of Winter Storm Hercules. I laughed out loud.
Andrew, thank you very, very much.
It's my pleasure.
Andrew Revkin teaches communications at Pace University and writes the Dot Earth blog for nytimes.com. Was Monday an especially tough day for you? Were you feeling sad? A little blue? The reason for your onset of melancholy is that January 6th was Blue Monday, reportedly the most depressing day of the year, based on science.
Today is Blue Monday.
You already know this probably.
It's the most depressing day of the year.
Mm. Calculated this. Here's why. The holidays are over.
Yep.
You have to go back to work. Weather outside, kind of gloomy,
sure.
Kind of gray.
The only problem with the reporting around this phenomenon, however, is that it is completely and utterly bogus, invented, phony, blue-oni. Dr. Ben Goldacre is author of the book Bad Science. Ben, welcome back to On the Media.
Thanks for having me.
Tell me about Blue Monday, how you first encountered it.
Well, I first came across this almost a decade ago when it was first concocted by a man called Cliff Arnolds. And he was paid by a travel company, Sky Travel, to produce this bogus equation to come up with the most depressing day of the year in the middle of January, specifically because that's when people are most likely to start thinking about booking their holidays. In fact, the very same chap produced a similar equation for Wall's Ice Cream Company, which was the happiest day of the year. And the happiest day of the year was in June, which is the beginning of ice cream purchasing season.
The equation that he came up with for seasonal melancholy wasn't based on any kind of science that you could detect.
No, I mean, it's back-of-the-envelope silliness. These are really basically just a PR company's attempt to get a brand into the media.
But they're so transparently unscientific that newspapers and other news organizations look at them and simply dismiss them out of hand, right?
No, that doesn't happen at all. In fact, they're incredibly prevalent, especially in the United Kingdom. I think these PR companies have correctly deduced that, firstly, it's more impactful to get your brand's name into the media on the news or op-ed pages than by paying for an advertisement. And they've also hacked the media in the sense that they have correctly identified science coverage as an area that is particularly poorly policed. The people who are really in charge in newsrooms, the sort of senior editors, they tend to have a good understanding of politics, economics, history, maybe sport, but they don't feel science in their belly. They have no interest in it. And so these rather silly stories are very easy for PR companies to get into the media.
Can you give me an example of some of the equations that purport to have some sort of mathematical substance to them?
Some of the ones just from one newspaper, the Daily Mail, over the course of a year or two, they had the formula for the perfect day, the perfect Christmas, the perfect bacon butty, the perfect present wrap, the perfect sitcom, the formula for staying awake at work, which is C times D times A plus CT plus KF, the perfect cheese sandwich. It really is absolutely extraordinary how prevalent this stuff is. And I think it's driven because people in newsrooms are shorter of resources every year. And so if somebody gives you a press release that has a quirky story, it's very tempting to just copy and paste it.
Come on, though. It's not as though a journalist, no matter how scientifically illiterate, can look at a series of numbers and letters with an equal sign in the middle of it, and really believe that it is a formula for the perfect cheese sandwich. Are we really that naive, or are we just actually cynical?
I think you should maybe talk to some of the journalists who happily cover these stories. I would say any journalist who writes about the most depressing day of the year is really declaring that they don't care what they write, that they have no integrity as a journalist. I had an extraordinary piece of luck in 2007 when one PR company, Clarion Communications, who were working for Veet, which is a cream for removing disgusting hair from ladies' legs. I don't think hair on ladies' legs is disgusting, by the way. But Clarion Communications got in touch with me and they said, "We're conducting a survey into the celebrity top 10 sexiest walks for our clients, Veet. And we would like to back up our survey with an equation from an expert to work out which celebrity has the sexiest walk with theory behind it. So we'd like help from a doctor of psychology or someone similar who can come up with equations to back up our findings, because we feel that having an expert comment and an equation will give the story more weight." So I wrote back and I said, "Well, yeah, sure, of course, great. You know, are there any factors you'd particularly like to have in the equation? Maybe something sexual?" And they wrote back saying, "Hey, Dr. Ben, we'd really like the factors of the equation to include the thigh to calf ratio, the shape of the leg, the look of the skin, and the wiggle, the swing of the hips. There's a fee of £500, which we pay you for your services," and so on. And there was even survey data, which was rigged. They actually said in their email, "We haven't conducted the survey yet, but we know what results we want to achieve. We want Beyoncé to come out on top, followed by other celebrities with curvy legs, such as J-Lo and Kylie, and celebrities such as Kate Moss and Amy Winehouse to be at the bottom. E.g., skinny and pale, unshapely legs are not as sexy." And then they go out and they employed, it turns out, a Cambridge academic. So this is reported not just in the Daily Telegraph, it also got a little nugget in Time magazine. A team of Cambridge mathematicians had discovered that Jessica Alba has the sexiest walk.
Well, that is just most depressing. And on the subject of depressing, I want to get back to Blue Monday. I think the reason it scans, in spite of all of your best attempts over the years to debunk it, is that it sounds so plausible.
But actually, you know, one study in Ontario found peaks of suicide in spring and autumn. Suicide's highest in summer, says a paper in Australia. Papers on general mood, where people just ask a questionnaire, found that low mood was more common in the summer in Finland, and so on. These stories really are, in the most comprehensive possible sense of the word, bullshit.
When you confront reporters and editors and scientists who have participated in these shenanigans about what they've done, what's their rationalization?
Well, with journalists, you get people saying, hey, it's all good fun. Everybody knows not to take those pages of the newspaper seriously, in which case, frankly, I think we should put a big flag telling readers that at the top of the page. A lot of journalists have terrible tantrums. And then some of the academics in particular are pretty brazen. Cliff Arnold, the man who came up with the equation for Blue Monday, sent me a very, very charming email in 2006 when I first wrote about it. He says, "Dear Ben, further to your mentioning my name in conjunction with Wall's ice cream, I have just received a further check from them. Cheers and season's greetings, Cliff Arnold."
He got a bonus.
That was a happy Christmassy feeling for me too.
Tell me, what is the formula for a happy Christmas?
It's media whore plus corporate slut equals money.
Ben, thank you very much.
Thanks, boss.
Physician, scientist, and author Ben Goldacre writes at badscience.net. His most recent book is Bad Pharma.
Coming up, more Tommy Rott in Hocus Pocus.
This is On the Media.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Back in October, when healthcare.gov was foundering on its shakedown cruise, we reported on the case of Chad Henderson, a young man who supposedly had successfully navigated the Federal Health Exchange. Except it emerged that Henderson was active in a pro-Obamacare advocacy group and that he hadn't actually enrolled for Affordable Health Act coverage. Here was Politico's Kyle Cheney telling us how he got suckered by a partisan ringer.
We were clear that this was an Obama supporter, but described in great detail getting through the enrollment process and selecting a plan and talking about his inability to get insurance from the time he was 6 years old. All the facts were on the table. The only fact that wasn't on the table was that he hadn't actually enrolled.
Well, now that the exchange is up and running, another dubious narrative is all the rage. The Obamacare horror story. Tales of people whose health insurance policies have been canceled and who now face either skyrocketing premiums or no insurance at all. Maggie Mahar is a health policy writer who, steeped in the details of the Affordable Care Act, became very suspicious of the nightmares being described in the media. Maggie, welcome to On the Media.
Hi.
Your inquiry started when you saw a piece in the Fort Worth Star-Telegram about local Fort Worth Obamacare nightmares. Tell me about that story.
It was a very compelling story. She was a 26-year-old new mother with a 2-month-old, and she was suffering from MS. She needed very expensive medication. And after her policy was canceled, she said that the only insurance she could find would cost her over $1,000. I knew that couldn't be true. First of all, under Obamacare, insurers cannot charge you more because of a pre-existing condition. Secondly, under Obamacare, 20-somethings pay very low premiums compared to older people. I went online, I plugged in her name, the county she lived in, the fact that she was trying to insure one person, and found that she could get insurance on the exchange for roughly $350 a month.
Now, that there is your due diligence.
That's right.
Apparently not exercised by the Fort Worth Star-Telegram in the first instance. So you finally did catch up with the reporter and confronted her with the facts that you've just enumerated. What did she say?
She told me that she was given 2 days to do the story. Her editor said, find people whose policies are canceled and are now left in a quagmire. So she put out messages to friends, to an insurance broker, looking for people, interviewed them, and wrote the story all in 1.5 days. It turned out when I checked the people in the story, there were 4 of them. 3 belonged to the Tea Party. 2 of them didn't even go to the exchange because they didn't want anything to do with Obamacare. Nevertheless, the paper described these people as victims of Obamacare.
Now, you don't think that the Star-Telegram was intentionally propagandizing for House Republicans?
No, I don't.
But everything else about this assignment seemed almost destined to produce shoddy journalism. How does something like this come to pass?
Lack of resources, first of all. The reporter told me that she doesn't really write about health care very often. She told me she knew very little about the Affordable Care Act. She covers 15 different beats. That's a problem to start with. Secondly, more and more journalists all over, not just at this paper, when they talk about health care reform, they don't cover the policy, they cover the politics. They cover it as if it's a sporting event. Who's winning, who's losing?
Does this really scary anecdote about the danger of stories with really scary anecdotes go beyond the Fort Worth incident, or is it an outlier?
No, unfortunately, it's become quite commonplace. I'm not the only journalist who's fact-checked these stories. Another story was on CBS and on 3 Fox shows. A woman named Wanda Barrett, she claimed that her premiums were jumping from $54 to $5.91 after her policy was canceled. It turned out, when someone at the Washington Post checked it, that her insurance that was only $54 was junk insurance. It didn't cover hospitalization. In other words, if she landed in the hospital, her insurance would not pay one penny. That's not insurance. Then there was a woman who appeared on NBC and CBS. Her name was Deborah Cavallaro.
I am currently paying $293 a month. And under Obamacare, depending on the plan that I go with, it's any place from $478 to $500 a month. And that's for a, quote, comparable plan to what I have. However, it is not comparable in that I cannot go to my doctors or my hospital.
Right.
So explain to me how it's better for me.
Yeah.
Someone at the American Prospect checked that story, found out that, in fact, with a subsidy, she could get insurance for $258. That's $35 less than her canceled policy.
Now, you are a reporter, and you're clearly well-versed in healthcare policy, but you also sound very much like an advocate for Obamacare. How are our listeners to conclude that you yourself are not skewing your fact-checking in order to bolster a political position?
I'm not an advocate for Obamacare. I'm an advocate for the truth. I've read the entire law 3 times. I know what's in it. And so when I read accounts of the legislation that are not true, I write about it. And unfortunately, we do know that many people who oppose Obamacare have said things that simply aren't true, and they've been printed and repeated. For instance, John Boehner tweeted the Fort Worth Telegram story, put it on his website, and he tweeted it. This means that John Boehner either doesn't know that no 26-year-old would be asked to pay $1,000 a month, or he does know that and didn't care about the truth.
As a news consumer, what should we first do when we see these anecdotal tales spun out for us?
Obviously, every reader isn't going to fact-check every story. You shouldn't have to. But if something strikes you as unlikely or odd, you can go to Google and very quickly check at least one fact.
And to the reporters who, as you described earlier, get assigned a healthcare story and have no grounding in healthcare policy, and they come up with a perfect poster child for a premise, what advice have you for them?
Google their name and Democrat, Google their name and Tea Party, Google their name and Republican. It's really very easy nowadays to do a background check on somebody to see if they have an axe to grind one way or the other. And that's what you want to know. You want to make sure that they're just an ordinary American and they're not stumping for something or someone.
Maggie, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Maggie Mahar is the editor of HealthBeat blog. She's also author of the book Money-Driven Medicine, The Real Reason Healthcare Costs So Much.
In 1925, a young high school teacher stood at the center of a religious maelstrom. John Scopes was accused of teaching the theory of evolution, that life evolved from earlier life forms, rather than creationism, the belief that we sprang forth just as we are from the mind of God. Scopes was found guilty and fined $100. The verdict was eventually overturned on a technicality, but the so-called Scopes monkey trial put the debate on front pages nationwide. The two big-name lawyers personified each side of the debate, William Jennings Bryan on the side of creationism and Clarence Darrow representing evolution. In the 1960 film Inherit the Wind, Scopes is Cates, and Darrow, well, he's Spencer Tracy. So though Cates loses his case, Tracy wins the argument.
For I intend to show this court that what Bertram Cates spoke quietly one spring morning in the Hillsborough High School is no crime. It is incontrovertible as geometry to any enlightened community of minds.
A recent Pew Research Center poll found that one-third of Americans reject the theory of evolution, believing that, quote, humans and other living things have existed in their present form since the beginning of time. Edward Caudill, author of Intelligently Designed, How Creationists Built the Campaign Against Evolution, says that the Scopes trial set a template for the media that ensures the matter will never be settled.
The template is that you take a science-religion issue and you make it political. If you say, hey, I've got this story about theology and the conflict of modern science, you can just see the reporter yawning. But if you come to him and say, look, we've got these townspeople who are up in arms about teaching this course that just violates all their principles, and there's going to be a lawsuit. You said legislation. You said local school board. You said conservative and liberal. This is language that reporters understand. Now we've got two sides. This is how we write a news story.
Reporters are obliged to cover politics in the courts and the legislature and the local school board.
With the law of the land. How can you not cover it? I just don't see the media finding a good way out of this because you're being victim of your own ethics here. Be fair. Tell the other side, even when the other side is not viable. You're giving them legitimacy by interviewing me on this subject today. I give them legitimacy by writing a book about an idea that's basically nonsensical and equates it with one of the great scientific ideas in history.
Now, during the Scopes trial, Baltimore Sun journalist H.L. Mencken wrote about Bryan and the creationists, quote, peculiar imbecilities and theologic bilge. And ever since those withering portrayals, creationists have struggled with an image problem. If we fast forward to the 1980s, you say they came up with a genius plan for dealing with that.
That was the term intelligent design. By saying, I'm an intelligent design advocate, you're simply saying, behind all of this, it is so complex, so beautiful, so brilliant, there must have been a designer. It gives you a way in to sound scientific. We've equated science and technology with progress. So I can't come along and say, look, let's forget all this science nonsense. Then you're regressive.
You're falling into theological bilge water, according to Mencken.
Yeah, you're one of Mencken's rubes, hillbillies, and ignoramuses.
One thing that I learned from you was something called the wedge strategy, an anti-evolution manifesto, apparently, that was laid down in something called the wedge document. What was it?
The wedge document was a long-term tactical campaign plan for getting creationism into the American mainstream, including being taught in public schools. It emerged in the early 90s. It talks about the creation of publicity, academic articles, TV, radio appearances, newspaper and magazine articles, and how they'll confront the scientific community.
The five-year goals include to see intelligent design theory as an accepted alternative in the sciences, to see major new debates in education, life issues, The 20-year goal is to see intelligent design theory as the dominant perspective in science, permeating religion, culture, and moral and political life.
It is audacious. The use of the term intelligent design, for example, you're not saying Christian. This gets you around the Establishment Clause violation.
The constitutional prescription against creating a national religion.
That's right. You can't show preference for a religion. And creationism clearly is a preference for fundamentalist Christianity. So when I say, no, I didn't say God, I didn't say Old Testament, I said intelligent designer. A designer can just be whatever you want him to be. Well, that's a way of dodging the Establishment Clause restriction.
In that recent Pew survey we mentioned, some 67% of Democrats believe in the theory of evolution, compared to 43% of Republicans. That's a 24-point gap, a gap that has increased from a 10-point difference in 2009.
This is really telling us that creationists have successfully glued themselves onto a part of the Republican Party that rejects evolution, rejects some civil rights, such as gay marriage, that also is going to hold to the idea that this was founded as a Christian nation. And I think that's part of what's brilliant about it, is that you bundle the issue of intelligent design, and you say, if you buy into this, you're buying into my position on abortion, on individual rights, which means freedom of religion, freedom of expression, and you say, we are the rebels against this totalitarian system that dictates you must believe in evolution, and your children will be taught evolution by force because you have to pay taxes. Gosh, that sounds awful, doesn't it?
Edward, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Edward Caudill is a professor of the University of Tennessee, Knoxville, and author of the book, Intelligently Designed, How Creationists Built the Campaign Against Evolution. We are easy to go when it suits our worldview or when it amuses us, but there are times when we're just sitting at home, eating dinner, say, and bogosity literally comes calling. OTM producer Chris Neary has that story.
About a month ago, around noon, Time Magazine Washington Bureau Chief Michael Scherer was closing that week's issue of the magazine when he got a call on his cell phone.
It's really a delightful voice. Incredibly engaging, friendly, slightly flirty.
Hello, how are you today? I'm calling about an online request you once made about health insurance coverage.
I have health insurance that I'm quite happy with. And I started talking back to her just sort of as a prank, and I realized that her responses were pretty canned. And so I said, you're a computer, right? And she had a very charming laugh.
I am a real person. Maybe we have a bad connection. I'm sorry about that.
Through the afternoon, Samantha West kept calling, and Sherry became more and more suspicious.
I looked at my cell phone and realized that I could call her whenever I wanted, and she would answer the phone as if she was calling me. And so I told the other people in my bureau that we should find out what's going on.
One of those people was Zeke Miller. He covers the White House for Time.
Michael walked down the hall to my office and said, dial this number.
Hello, how are you today? Well, I'm calling about an online request you once made about health insurance.
Intrigued by Samantha's dubious humanity, Zeke and another Time reporter, Denver Nix, pressed the issue, repeatedly calling her back using the number on Cher's cell phone.
We work with all major companies and compare all the rates for you.
Oh, cool.
I can get you a quote in about 5 minutes. Yes.
What's your name?
Okay, Samantha West.
Miller and Nix called Samantha West about 10 times. When they began by asking, are you a robot? She'd politely hang up. So they learned to humor her by answering a few of her healthcare questions, building slowly to the only question that matters when you suspect the person you're talking with is a robot.
You really do sound like a robot.
I am a real person. Maybe we have a bad connection. I'm sorry about that.
Are you sure?
Yes.
At some point, Nix discarded the politeness you'd afford another human being.
It would just make me feel so much better to hear you say, I am not a robot.
What? Let me ask you a couple of questions. Are you currently on Medicare?
No, I'm not.
Okay.
But now let me ask you a question.
Medicaid or looking for Medicaid?
We'll go, you ask me a question, then I'll ask you a question. How about that?
Sure.
Okay, are you a robot?
No.
If you search Samantha West on the internet, you'll see not every telemarketing target is so skeptical. You see comments like,
I always hang up on her because she calls and identifies herself and then says nothing. I don't know what she wants, but I'm blocking her
number.
Samantha
West keeps calling me from 412-430-5588, even though I keep telling her to stop calling me.
Samantha West is not unique.
My name is Amanda Thomas, and I'm going with Corporation for Character on behalf of
Corporation.
I'm so sorry. I'm having a hard time hearing anything you're saying. I'll have a manager call back from a better phone shortly.
The Tampa Bay Times and the Center for Investigative Journalism looked at charities that use these kinds of calls. That's where these recordings are from.
What color is the sky?
Well, I thank you so much for your time today. Maybe you can help out on the next drive. Take care and have a good day, okay?
You're not a real person.
Bye-bye.
People who are fooled by Samantha West and her ilk don't record their calls, and some of them probably buy insurance. But listening to that kind of tape, it's impossible to conclude she's a real person, which means she's a robot.
Samantha West is not a robot. If we wanted to give Samantha West a catchy title, I would say Samantha West is a cyborg.
The Atlantic's Alexis Madrigal has written at length about the Samantha West of the world. A brief note for non-sci-fi fans. A cyborg is a human who has their mind or body augmented by technological devices.
What Samantha West is a person sitting either in Utah or the Philippines, my guess is the Philippines, pressing buttons on a computer that play pre-recorded audio to a call receiver.
So when a telemarketing target picks up a call from Samantha West, they hear her energetic, perky voice. But there's a human operator controlling what that voice says by clicking on the right button.
They can hit, for example, L to laugh, and they can just keep hitting the L to do that. So it's like... But the idea is that the operator gets really good at using these little conversational asides in order to, like, make the conversation feel natural. So another example, you hit the equal sign and say, exactly. Hit the equal sign. Exactly.
While cyborg Samantha West may be unsettling to contemplate, Madrigal says he found versions of Samantha West that were, if not honest, at least more honest. And some of the companies who sell Samantha-like systems claim it can prevent fraud.
And the reason is, when you have a bunch of call center workers where the turnover is like 400%, multiple times the turnover at a fast food restaurant, you've got people whose incentives do not necessarily align with always saying exactly the right thing. I mean, these are people who are living pretty close to the edge of survival, making ends meet. And you've got their managers relentlessly flogging them, trying to get them to make more sales. And so what you have is people sometimes say, don't read all the disclosures that they're supposed to read because they know it'll take too much time and they might lose the sale. And so the big pitch, actually, for a lot, particularly the American-based companies that sell this technology, is that every single thing will be said exactly as the script wanted it said.
Madrigal has great sympathy for telemarketers. When he was a teenager, he was a telemarketer, a bad one.
The voice that you're hearing now did not sell many people in, like, Macon, Georgia on material safety data sheet software, but there was another woman who worked there named Kimberly who was just absolutely fantastic at the sales game. If we had had access to this technology at that time, I can tell you, I would have loved to press all the buttons using Kimberly's melodious voice. And I think people forget that on the other side of a telemarketing call is some person who's been sitting in a call center dialing for dollars for 10 hours. What really got me interested in this whole system of pre-recorded audio is that maybe it's better for those workers, because I do think that psychologically, people have a really hard time imagining what it would be like to be rejected 150 times a day. It's bad for a social animal to experience that.
But the people getting calls from cyborgs are social animals, too. Nobody likes being lied to. And in fact, the operator behind a Samantha West is free to jump into the conversation at any time and initiate a human-to-human interaction. So there's nothing stopping a righteous operator from making an honest woman of Samantha West.
Can that overcome the kind of original sin that you're not talking to another human's voice? I don't know. If Tommy in Utah is placing the call, is listening to the call, is responding to you live, like, are you talking to a human?
We already have automated tutors, diagnosticians, and bureaucrats. But we know they're machines. What if cyborg salespeople like Samantha did come clean? Here's one of the Time reporters, Denver Nix.
You know, what would I have done if she had said, yeah, I'm a robot? Anyway, as we were saying, I don't know what I would have said. That's heavy, man. I guess, you know, she was trying to enroll me in health insurance, and I would have just said, like, oh, you know, thanks for answering my question. I'm sorry I was being such a jerk. I have health insurance. Have a nice day.
So Samantha West could actually help. Telemarketing is often a scam. What if honesty could be automated? For On the Media, I'm Chris Neary.
Coming up, the FBI rebrands itself again.
This is On the Media.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. In a recent article for Foreign Policy, reporter John Hudson noted a quiet substitution in the FBI's fact sheet. Its primary mission had been changed from law enforcement to national security. He was alerted to the switch by national security lawyer Kel McClanahan, who said, quote, I think they're trying to rebrand. So many good things happen to your agency when you tie it to national security. Former New York Times intelligence reporter Tim Weiner and author of Enemies, A History of the FBI, says that this change reflects what really has always been the case.
Well, this is like the National Weather Service putting out a bulletin saying that the sun will rise in the east tomorrow. The fact is that throughout almost all of its 105-year history, the FBI's primary mission has been intelligence and national security. Do you really think J. Edgar Hoover was interested in bank robbers and car thieves? He was really interested in communists and terrorists.
Mm-hmm.
The reason that we associate the FBI and J. Edgar Hoover and its legacy with don't shoot, G-Man, is that back in the 1930s, in the depths of the Depression, there was indeed a crime wave, and there was a government war on crime. This was run by Franklin Delano Roosevelt's Attorney General, Homer Cummings, but he could not be the face of the war on crime because he looked like a librarian. J. Edgar Hoover, on the other hand, looked like a bulldog. Yes, he did. A bulldog with a Tommy gun.
And so he
became the face of the war on crime. But this interested him not a whit. Communists, terrorists, anarchists, people who threatened the United States national security were his first, second, third, fourth, fifth, and sixth priority. And aside from an interregnum, which coincides almost exactly with the Bill Clinton administration, national security intelligence has been job one at the FBI.
Okay, so if this is an acknowledgement of what has been the longstanding reality of the FBI's priorities, why is it rebranding itself, if that's what it's doing, now?
The FBI has a new leader. His name is Jim Comey. He was the deputy attorney general and the acting attorney general during a period of great crisis in this country back in March of 2004. The President of the United States had sent two of his White House aides to the bedside of the Attorney General, John Ashcroft,
mm-hmm.
who was near death, and tried to get him to re-sign a presidential order, which we now know involved illegal and extra-constitutional spying by the National Security Agency. Jim Comey, who was the acting attorney general, stood in the path of that speeding freight train and stopped it. Comey developed a reputation in the intelligence community as the guy who would say no, as opposed to the man who would say yes, sir. He needs to reestablish himself as the new head of the FBI and reassert his primacy in the field of national security. The other intelligence services, the National Security Agency, CIA, they have no police powers. If they did, this would not be the United States. It would be Soviet Russia. where your Foreign Intelligence Services has internal police power. The Bureau is the ultimate recipient of the intelligence that the NSA and the CIA collect. And they need to be regarded within the government and by the American people as a national security agency. It is a recognition of a reality that few Americans grasp.
One that the FBI would like us to grasp and like the media to play up.
Certainly that, but something more. The more people understand that what they do involves primarily secret intelligence operations, and that they are indeed a law enforcement agency as well, may help people understand that the calibration of the balance between freedom and security rests in part with the FBI. The enormous power to destroy people and the enormous responsibility to protect the Constitution and our civil liberties.
Can you imagine what would happen if those powers were actually turned to the people who destroyed our economy?
It would be a bloodbath on Wall Street.
John Hudson pointed out that there has been a steep decline in the prosecution of white-collar crimes. Back in 2000, he reports, the FBI sent prosecutors 10,000 cases. That fell to 3,500 in 2005. If the FBI isn't doing law enforcement, then who is?
The Bureau ultimately has to investigate, prosecute, and convict white-collar criminals. And if 90% of your agents are out chasing guys named Muhammad, then they're not chasing guys named Thatcher, Baxter, Hatcher.
Well, but Tim, that's exactly my question. If they're not, who is?
Nobody.
Okay.
If Congress, in its wisdom, and perhaps freed from the considerable financial contributions of the banking community, saw fit to create a Federal Bureau of Financial Investigation, then we might get somewhere. But it's very hard to do one thing well at once. It's very, very hard to do two things well at once. And the Bureau was called upon to protect and defend the national security of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And the enemies list at that time did not include Goldman Sachs, Lehman Brothers, and others whose names I'm too polite to mention at this moment.
Tim, thank you very much.
All right, thanks.
Former New York Times reporter Tim Weiner is author of Enemies, A History of the FBI, and Legacy of Ashes, The History of the CIA.
Gee, but I'd like to be a G-man and go bang, 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 bang. I'd be a brave gangbusting he-man and go bang, 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 bang. I'd put on disguises of all different sizes, and would I win prizes for telling who spies is?
I'll tell you, things have really changed.
Ronald Kessler is author of Inside the FBI, the world's most powerful law enforcement agency.
Under Hoover, the Bureau created this image of this invincible agency where they always got their man. They did this through the media, through radio shows, TV shows, movies that they controlled.
Many of the incidents in the story you are about to hear are based on the actual records and authentic experiences of Matt Savetic, who for 9 fantastic years lived as a communist for the FBI.
J. Edgar Hoover policed the agency's image through an office with the impenetrable name of the Crimes Records Division. It was charged with furnishing what were called interesting case memoranda to the radio shows and later the TV shows and movies over which Hoover exercised an invincible veto power. He was ever vigilant in pursuit of good PR.
I am your new director. I did not ask for the position, but now that I have it, I intend to give it the best I have. The Bureau will operate solely on efficiency, and we are going to do it as a team.
Once upon a time, Hollywood loved the organization.
David Edelstein is the film critic for New York Magazine.
There was something very, very reassuring about the discipline, the order, the routine, the sticking to the rules. There was something very reassuring about those men in those gray suits, all with identical haircuts.
But the love affair had cooled for the average American in the mid-70s with the Senate investigation of the FBI under Frank Church. This week, we learned the real story of civic-minded burglars who slipped into an FBI office late one night in 1971 and stole out with suitcases full of documents exposing how the agency was spying on and interfering with anti-war and civil rights activists in an explicit attempt to paralyze them with paranoia. The information leaked to the press, which gave rise to the Church Committee and new restrictions on the FBI.
That pretty much blew the lid off all of the FBI horrors that Hoover had kept, you know, bottled up over all those years.
Richard Powers is the author of G-Men, Hoover's FBI in American Popular Culture.
Once you have an image that the FBI promoted during the 1930s of being an omnipotent, all-knowing, all-powerful agency that never could make a mistake, it was setting itself up for a terrible fall.
So the image of the FBI splintered. Films like the Die Hard series showed up the FBI as officious and obstructionist bureaucrats.
Al, talk to me. What's going on here?
That's the FBI. They got the universal terrorist playbook, and they're running it step by step.
Meanwhile, the Bureau regained a measure of its old omniscience with a Jodie Foster vehicle.
Yeah, Starling, tell me what you see.
Oh, he's a white male. Serial killers tend to hunt within their own ethnic groups. He's not a drifter. He's got his own house somewhere, not an apartment.
What?
What he does with them takes privacy. And he's never impulsive. He'll never stop.
Why not?
Got a real taste for it now, and he's getting better at his work.
Not bad, Starling.
Louis Starling and Silence of the Lambs probably did more for the Bureau as a fictional case than any real case, any real publicity that the Bureau could have done. It was amazing.
Ex-profiler John Douglas is the model for Agent Starling's mentor, Jack Crawford, played by Scott Glenn.
A lot of high-ups in the FBI itself at first didn't like the movie. They said it was very, very violent. And when I went to a movie screening, I got up and I said, I don't know what the rest of you think in the FBI. I see this work day in and day out.
Damn, you know, who wouldn't want to sign up and go out and hunt themselves some serial killers?
Critic David Edelstein says that despite anecdotal evidence to the contrary, the gods of Tinseltown have consistently favored the Bureau with positive portrayals.
In the beginning, the FBI was all that stood between us freedom-loving Americans and those nasty immigrant gangsters. Then the FBI was all that stood between us and that evil communist menace. Then when the communist menace no longer seemed so imminent, suddenly the FBI was out doing battle with right-wing white supremacists and the Ku Klux Klan.
Even the X-Files, which depicts a dark and dangerous place, an agency at war with itself, has proved a boon to the FBI. As long as it seems powerful, the Bureau can't lose.
It's only in very, very, very rare instances that the FBI is portrayed as incompetent, which seems to me the worst danger to an organization that thrives on secrecy and that presents itself as a model of superhuman and enlightened efficiency.
In the wake of criticism that the FBI may have dropped the ball on Boston bombers and failed to pursue white-collar criminals and racially profiled, as the new FBI chief sorts through his agency's priorities, he might want to consider beefing up the Bureau in Hollywood.
Criminals come, but they have one way to go. Gangsters are dumb, for by now they ought to know. Stick you up there or they gang you over there. Hoover will bring them to the electric chair.
D-D-E-F-T, G-Man, G-Man, Hoover. Rat-tat-tat, rat-tat-tat.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sara Burkman, Chris Neary, and Laura Mayer. We had more help from Kimi Regler and Mira Sharma. And our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Andrew Dunn and Justin Gerrish.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Step out the door, there's Hoover waiting there. A-B-C-D-E-F-G,
He-Man, He-Man, Hoover.
You were smart, cruel, had no heart, fool. You were bad, he